This is Pure Decking, show number 378 for Thursday, January 30th. I don't know. Have we figured out a funny joke on the year yet? I haven't. So,
just not really.
Yeah, it's the everyone's still writing 2019 so, on their paperwork. That's the joke right now. Is at work every time you see a handwritten note or form, you see 2019 with 2020 scribbled over it.
I think this is the first year I haven't actively fucked that up.
Oh, I have, and I know several other people have, so luckily, mostly for me, it's all digital, so it's really easy to fix, but
tomorrow I get to notarize a few million things, probably fuck up once.
Yeah. This is the show about stuff that interests me, like information security, rigging the game, and getting trashed on airplanes. I'm Morps. Tonight, we have Madman. What's up, Madman?
Nothing much. Drinking and wondering why PETA wants to outsource our jobs to robots.
Oh, PETA wants robots to skin the minks now?
Oh, no, but they want to replace Punxsutawney Phil with a robot. They think it's too stressful for a groundhog to do 3 minutes of work every year.
Wow.
Do you see your shadow or not? That's all it's fucking doing. And then he gets free room and board and food. For another year, or until it dies and they replace it with another groundhog that the name Punxsutawney Phil.
So here's the thing I've never understood about Groundhog Day. It's always based on does the groundhog see its shadow. So is it literally just on the direction the groundhog's facing? Like, if it doesn't turn around and see, oh, there's the shadow on the ground, you know, I mean, whether the shadow is there or not, I mean.
I don't know. Did they come up with this crap?
Did they get a CNN reporter down there to ask Punxsutawney what he thinks about the Orange Man? Because if not, I don't care.
I don't know about that, but they're going to take his job and replace him with a robot. That means we're going to have one less groundhog, you know,
They can't release him back into the wild. He doesn't know how to live. That is Yang Bucks. He'll be fucked.
Well, it's going to be better than what happened to Staten Island Chuck.
See, they're just going to go out there and say, be free, and the little girl will throw the groundhog in the air, and it'll land in the street and get ran over. Sort of like that YouTube video with the eagle.
Didn't the New York mayor kill that one?
Yes, like, dropped him.
Dropping it on its head? Was that Bloomberg?
Yes.
So Bloomberg, the groundhog murderer, now running for emperor.
He has paid Google a lot of money, because if you're trying to watch YouTube on something that doesn't have ad block going, I mean, every fucking ad is Bloomberg.
$20 million a day is what he's spending.
My God.
So you spend $20 million a day for a $100,000 job. Yeah, makes sense to me.
I don't think we finished the intro. RU is here.
I'm more interested in talking about Bloomberg, who likes to kill animals. Especially furry cute ones. I think they should be, you know, he should be introduced like that, and the former mayor of New York who likes to kill animals. You know?
Well, in his defense, Chuck did bite him.
But I would too, if New York mayor fucking grabbed me, I'd bite him too.
Yeah, you're not supposed to reach down into the hole to pull the groundhog.
Oh, this is starting to make sense now, because I saw a video of him yesterday trying to pat a dog. He put his hand inside the dog's mouth.
No, he grabbed the snout.
He doesn't know how to pat animals. That makes sense now. Why the groundhog bit him. I think we need more photo opportunities with the former mayor.
Well, you know, most animals are able to sense pure evil. It's been chemically proven. And, you know, they just react.
I'm just going to put the call out there for pit bull owners. If you got a pit bull, take it down to a Bloomberg rally and see how your pit bull goes.
It's going to be like the Tribbles in that episode of Star Trek, you know, with the bad guy and they go nuts. Except with, you know, pit bulls and probably a lot more screaming.
So, receipt will be in the mail there, Mr. Bloomberg, for our mentioning you on the show. If Google can get some money, so can we.
That'd be a fun scam to pull during, you know, like if you got in a little bit earlier on the primaries, you know, sending a bill for some consulting fee and see if they pay it. I mean, it's a classic scam, right? Just to make up a consultancy fee and send it to a company and see if they pay it. But because sometimes they will. They don't pay that good of attention to their books. And especially if your thing says something vague like consulting. So if you're doing a presidential, you could do like social media consulting, consulting for whatever. Because usually with these things, their staff members' names are published somewhere. So, you know, if you want a social engineer, of course, you know, you want to talk social engineering. Right now, the thing's going to be taxes. I should play. I got a fun one today. I should play it. Let's see. I'm just going to hold my phone up to the microphone here. Voicemail. Where is it?
Heavy, no!
All right, scream if it sounds like ass.
The service has filed a lawsuit against you regarding tax deficiency and tax fraud. Ignoring this will be an intentional second attempt to avoid federal law. For any further information, immediately speak to our federal agent callback number 717-384-5095. I repeat 717-384-5095.
I highly recommend calling the number and just playing horrible things. Like get a bullhorn and just, you know, blast your phone or whatever. I don't give a fuck.
Oh no, pipe Larry through it.
Yeah. Yeah, just call him, just have the robot sitting there going, you know, playing old man. Or Lenny, or whatever that thing was.
Yeah, whatever his name was.
That'd be good. But, so the tax fraud stuff's going to be starting up since, you know, it's that time of year. So,
yeah.
I especially like if you ignore this voicemail, that's considered another violation of federal law. It's like, uh-huh. For the record, if the IRS is trying to get a hold of you, they will send you a letter via registered mail. Not a phone call with a computer voice.
It must work, though, because they keep doing it.
Oh, you know, it's got... That's the thing, is that voice is better. They used to use, like, the really old, bad AT&T voices. That one seems actually almost believable. I could see somebody believing that.
Yeah, we got a scam here where they're like, if you don't respond to this, it comes through your house phone, that your internet will be cut off permanently and you'll be fined for not replying or something.
Yeah.
And it's actually quite a good robot female voice. Like you can tell it's still a computer, but it's a lot better than, as you said, the old AT&T computer voice.
So what a lot of the robocalls do now is they're still a robot, but they've had somebody sit there and record the lines. And so, you know, it sounds like a real person, but they're just playing back pre-recorded lines. And what's really fun is when you figure out you've got one of those, if you start saying nonsense to it, a lot of times you'll screw it up and it'll go back to the top of the call tree.
Oh, that's cool.
So you can get it in loops and fuck with it, you know, that way. But of course, you're just wasting time on the phone. And it used to be that you were taking, you know, if you were wasting a scammer's time, then you were preventing them from calling anybody else. But it's all automated now. So while you're on the phone with them, their VoIP dialer is still making 1,000 other calls a second. So
yeah, it's just unfortunate, but the way of the world, man. We're getting replaced. Even scammers aren't scammers anymore. The scammers have become robots.
Yeah, Rats has got it down. He's talking about the Jim from X Campaign. Talk about our veterans. The one I usually get is they ask for, you know, like an Earl or Esmond or, you know, some name like that. And, you know, you say you have the wrong number. They go, well, maybe you can help me. And then go into their spiel. And it's like, uh-huh. So...
Anyways. Oh, yeah, I usually get, would you like to donate to some cop charity or some fire department charity?
Yeah.
Like, I give to the boat. I'll talk to you later.
So, anyways. But yeah, the way I found a script, those scripts is just keep saying, "I can't hear you. I can't hear you." They'll fuck up and just keep repeating. It's hilarious.
I'm going to try that next time I get that female robot. Just start fucking with it and see if I can get it to bloop up or something.
Never say yes to it because they might record that and use it to put shit on your phone bill. But, nonsense, languages it's not expecting, and the I can't hear you or I can't understand you are good. So, because what it'll do is it'll eventually give up and disconnect, or it'll actually try to connect you to one of their operators. And so it goes from some, redneck accent, cowboy sounding guy to, Habib from,
That's a good one. I'm going to do the Unabomber Manifesto in a Eastern European sort of accent.
Or just start repeating. I wonder what it would do if you just start repeating its script back to it, like a bad game of Simon.
Ooh, that's cool. Maybe logic loop it up or something.
Well, it's looking for keywords, right? So I don't know what it's going to do, but it'd be kind of fun. Anyways, what I thought might be interesting to talk about to open the show, other than the scam calls, was this article the EFF put out. And I already threw the links in. Cool. So the EFF put out this article, Why the Public Wi-Fi is a Lot Safer Than You Think. Really?
Okay. Well, it will be a lot safer than you think, but it's probably more dangerous than most people think.
That's a good point, Madman. my own personal paranoia. So anyways, if you follow security on the internet, you may have seen articles warning you to beware of public Wi-Fi networks. BSV isn't on the show anymore, so I can use that whenever the hell I want. In cafes, airports, hotels, and other public places. But now, due to widespread deployment of HTTPS encryption, most popular websites advice to avoid public Wi-Fi is mostly out of date and applicable to a lot fewer people than it once was. So the conclusion here is most websites are using HTTPS, so it's okay to connect to any old random Wi-Fi.
I don't know, Jim. You'd have to sell me a little harder on this one.
Yeah. Let's see. Oh, they don't have the author. Do they have the author? Jacob. Yeah, the author's name is actually Jacob, so we can make fun of Jacob here in a minute. The advice stems from early days of the internet when most communication was not encrypted. At the time, somebody could snoop on your network communications, for instance, by sniffing packets from unencrypted Wi-Fi or by being the NSA. They could read your email. They could also steal your passwords or your login cookies and impersonate you on your favorite sites. This was widely accepted as a risk of using the internet. Sites that used HTTPS on all pages were safe. About that. But such sites were vanishingly rare. However, starting in 2010, all of that changed. Eric Butler released FireSheep, an easy-to-use demonstration of sniffing insecure HTTP to take over people's accounts. Site owners started to take note and realized they needed to implement HTTPS. For every page on the site, the timing was good. Earlier that year, Google had turned on HTTPS by default for all Gmail users and reported that the costs to do so were quite low. Hardware and software had advanced to the point where encrypting web browsing traffic was easy and cheap. However, a practical deployment of HTTPS across the whole web took a long time. One big obstacle was the difficulty for webmasters and site administrators of buying and installing a certificate. EFF helped launch Let's Encrypt and the CertBot script to help make it easier. Meanwhile, lots of site owners were changing their software and HTML in order to use HTTPS. Been tremendous progress. Still a few small leaks. Okay, here we go. There are still a few small information leaks. HTTPS protects the content of your communications, but not the metadata. So when you visit HTTPS sites along the communication path from your ISP to the internet backbone provider to the site's hosting provider, they can see your domain names and when you visit them, but the parties can't see the pages you visit on those sites. Your login name, the messages you send. They can see the sizes of page you visit and the sizes of files you download or upload. When you use public Wi-Fi network, people within range of it could listen in. They'd also be able to see that metadata, just like your ISP could. If this is acceptable risk, then you shouldn't worry about it. Similarly, if there's software with known security bugs on your computer or phone, those bugs are specifically exploitable only on the local network, you might be at a somewhat increased risk. The best advice is to keep your software up to date. So, and then the risk of governments is that they go upstream. They don't really bother with the open Wi-Fi, which that part's true. So here's the thing. I still wouldn't use public Wi-Fi without like a VPN connection or something. Because, whereas, yes, a lot of web traffic now is encrypted and going over HTTPS, that doesn't preclude other ways of messing with you when you're trying to use public Wi-Fi. And it depends on the Wi-Fi. Some are a lot better than others. A lot of the more modern open hotspots do what's called client isolation, and that's where the only client you can talk to, or the only thing you can talk to on the network, is the default gateway. So your traffic can go up and down, but you can't talk to any of the other clients on the network, which is a good setting. And I've seen some public places using that, but not as many as I'd like. I would say that I did see it at a local Starbucks one time when I was exploring. Anyways, testing out various hardware. But the thing is, there are, well, of course, the Wi-Fi Pineapple exists, as well as homegrown hardware. You can set up Raspis as open networks. You know, this article is probably talking more about, like, known hotspots, like a Starbucks or a McDonald's or an airport or things like that. But, you know, if I'm wanting to fuck with people on Wi-Fi in this modern age, I don't just go connect to Starbucks Wi-Fi and see who I can screw with just because we're all on the same network, right? What I do is I set up a fake access point, usually using a Raspberry Pi and a USB battery, and name it something like free public Wi-Fi, or, you know, name it similar to Starbucks Wi-Fi, and then see who connects to it. And then on that Raspberry, I'll have another Wi-Fi card on it, and it will be connected to the actual free Wi-Fi so that whoever connects to it is actually still getting on the internet. And now I've got a man-in-the-middle point, and I can run things like SSL strip. I can run things like SSL host inspection. That's a little bit more difficult because you actually need a legit certificate to do cert signing for the proxying. And it's been a bit since I've done that one because... But it works, and with things like Let's Encrypt, getting certificates isn't that hard. Getting a signing certificate's a little bit different. But actually, we were playing around with Let's Encrypt one time, and we were generating a lot of... I think they fixed it, but for a while there, you could generate certs for whatever you wanted. So, anyways. Oh, that wasn't Let's Encrypt. What was that? That was one of the other freebie ones before they shut it down. Fuck, I've forgotten the name. It's been a decade since I've done this, okay? And it wasn't a Raspberry, it was a laptop at the time, but, you know, still. If I was to do it today, it'd be a Raspberry, because then you could have it in a bag and nobody even notice. But, you know, so, I don't, you know, this article is saying, oh, just connect to any old public Wi-Fi, it's fine, everybody uses HTTPS. That is a terrible idea. That is absolutely not a good idea. You need a VPN if you're going to use public wireless or wireless networks that you don't trust and control. Like, you know, I'll use Wi-Fi at work. I'll use Wi-Fi at home. That's about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hotel Wi-Fi with a VPN. That'd be it. I wouldn't use it.
Dude, hotel Wi-Fi is like touching the remote control. You never know what you're going to get. You know,
you don't really know whose network you're connecting to.
That's right. Exactly.
I've never gone to the clerk and be like, so is this thing marked Best Western Wi-Fi number 12 actually your Wi-Fi?
I have. I got kicked out of a hospital because I went up to the front desk and I said, you all need to look at this. You've got an open Wi-Fi access point on your network. I got kicked out. They thought I was hacking their network.
They thought you were hacking their network because you said you have a hackable network.
Yeah. I'm like, wow. No, I'm not hacking your network. I'm picking up my sister. You need to get your computer guys to look at this. It's a problem. and they asked me to leave. So I had to wait outside for my sister. Not that it mattered. I could still see the Wi-Fi from my fucking phone.
My phone will still try to auto-connect to that, even outside. I just wanted to let you know.
Well, the problem was that at that point I realized the people were idiots and it wasn't worth it. So, I mean, not to mention, you know, you want to scare yourself. Look up the script Car Metasploit. That's when you set up a Kali box to pretend to be any Wi-Fi. So when your laptop, phone, whatever, is scanning for access points it knows, other people can see what it's looking for because it beacons out saying, is this SSD ID out here? And also that they can just impersonate common ones like Linksys or Free Public Wi-Fi, you know, other common Wi-Fi names, which are easy enough to collect. And the script will then pretend to be that access point, allow the client to connect to it, and immediately start nailing it with scripts to try to take over the device. So, and you can run this shit off like a pineapple or a properly configured Raspberry or laptop. So, yeah, about that Wi-Fi. And on your phone, by the way, your phones and your tablets... if you're someplace where you're not expecting to use the Wi-Fi, turn it off because your phone's going to fucking beacon for access points it knows. So, in fact, it was one of the tests we, you know, worked with an auditor to do at work is, you know, set up a fake access points and see how many credentials you can collect from people trying to connect to it because they cloned one of our main access points. Guess what? They got a lot. So,
yeah.
You know,
most of them would have been auto connects anyway.
Well, they went and set up the office park has a restaurant in it. So they just went and set up in the restaurant because where's most people go for lunch.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So. Yeah. This article is god awful advice.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's from the EFF.
They're usually a decent organization.
They are, but whoever wrote this article is just wrong.
Okay, I'll have to rephrase that. The only thing I keep up with EFF on is their legal division when they're taking someone to court or helping to defend someone, and those guys are usually pretty cool.
So, yeah, I mean, this article is just, I don't know, wrong.
Yeah.
You need to be careful anytime you're connecting to a Wi-Fi network that you don't trust. You know, and for most people, that's going to be their Wi-Fi at home and their job. And I guess if you're a regular Starbucks user or something, but even then, you got to be careful with that shit because it's not your Wi-Fi. You know, like back in the day when Comcast is like, we're going to turn everyone's home router into a public access point. Fuck no! Come on!
Oh. Everyone's going to be arrested for child porn.
I mean, come on. So, you know, I mean, what do you want to mess with somebody? Cool, I'm going to set up a Comcast access point. All I got to do is drive around in an area that Comcast serves to get the name format. Cool, now I've set up my access point. I'll let you connect to it, and I can do all kinds of horrible things. Like, you know, to take Madman's example, you really want to screw with people, set up a little proxy server on your access point so that you're rewriting all of the web pages that come through it. And run like something like SSL scripting around most of them running HTTPS and replace the images. Maybe not with what Madman suggested, but look the old April Fool's prank upside down internet. That's something you could easily set up and run. And what that does is that runs a image magic script that just flips every image upside down. But you could.
Or take a screenshot of their homepage and then just take all the icons off the table. The front and just put the screenshot there.
Or, you know, go get a bunch of memes off 4chan or something, right? I mean, you know, just replace every image with a poorly scaled copy of Fool's Closed or something.
Oh, no, we got to bring Lolcats back.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, Lolcats, that'll work. random lolcats instead of, you know, the images you were expecting.
Or Hasselhoff, everyone.
I mean, it'll be MySpace all over again, right? So, but yeah, I don't know why this. They're saying, oh well, HTTPS everywhere is enough, when there's so many other ways to screw with people if you control their network, or if you can get into the same network they're using. Now, that said, you know, if it's a Starbucks or a McDonald's or some of the other more common public Wi-Fis, and you're sure, because unlike what Madman said, I have gone to the clerk at the hotel desk and asked him which is the right Wi-Fi.
Well, I was just thinking, are you ever really sure? Because if you're going through McDonald's drive-in, the only reason you know it's McDonald's is it's labeled McDonald's. I can label anything McDonald's.
I've got a Wi-Fi card with a directional antenna, so if I can see their access point, I can use the signal strength and figure out, is that really the right access point? But I guess most people don't carry those.
No, most people carry their phones.
So the Hackintosh with the two custom Wi-Fi cards and the antenna is overkill then?
Only if you're war driving, or not war driving.
No, that's the regular bag. So, yeah, copper tape and 3D printing, you can make a much cheaper cantenna than a, you know, well, lighter, anyways, than the old Pringles can. But, and copper tape is a lot cheaper than I expected when I started looking into this shit. Yeah, about that. So, hey, is the horse dead? Do we need to move on?
I think the horse may be dead.
Horse may be dead.
Mm-hmm. It's so dead, we're selling it in China.
Now aged in the piss of small children. Anyways, that's eggs they do that with, right?
Yeah.
I don't care because I'm not eating anything with urine or came out of an animal's butt. So, like, all the coffee aged in cat, I don't know.
But eggs come from a chicken's behind.
Yeah, but there's a type of coffee you can buy that's been eaten by a cat and shit out.
Gross.
Wash the beans off and brew it, and it's supposed to be wonderful. I'm not drinking any coffee shat out by any animal.
I have a cat. And I have to clean that litter box on a regular basis. I don't want to consume any food that smells like that. Just saying.
There's lots of animals. You can also get it shat out from an elephant.
No, you might clarify that you're arguing with the IRC.
Oh, yeah. Harat said he heard it was monkeys. There's probably monkey shit coffee, too. I'm just stating, I'm not drinking any coffee made from beans that have been shat out by any animal. I'm also not eating anything from animal shit or anything that's been pissed on. I mean, kimchi is close enough, but that's just it rotting in its own self. Oh, God, we've got links.
So,
Moving on.
This is from Android Authority. Forensics detectives say Android phones are now harder to crack than iPhones.
Rock on.
Well, it makes sense just from a hardware diversity and operating system diversity thought. So Android is more like Windows when it comes to mobile phones, in that you have a variety of hardware, a variety of people making Android phones. And whereas Samsung is probably the most common, there's a lot of Android phones out there. And there's a lot of different SKUs, and they're all running different versions, especially if you're, like, you know, buying the cheapy burner phones, or you just hang on to your phone for an extended period of time. I mean, Madman, you were using that Android phone for like a decade before you finally had to get a new one.
Yep.
So it makes sense. And then iPhones are a lot more heterogeneous, right? They're all, you know, you have an iPhone, it's an iPhone. Like, you know what it is. Whereas if you have an Android phone, it's like, well, if it's a Samsung, that's got a different interface than, say, a Lenovo Android phone. Or if you've got an HTC, a lot of those use the vanilla Android interface, and others use their own. So, you know. Anyways. The United States government, as well as U.S. law enforcement agencies, care a lot about iOS and Android encryption. Smartphone data can reveal a lot about terrorists, people who conduct mass shootings, and even general criminals. If officials conduct investigations properly, that data can be used in court as evidence. That's why there have been lots of headlines recently about the U.S. government trying to convince companies such as Apple to hand over so-called backdoor access to smartphone data. However, critics argue that the government having easy access to your private data pretty much defeats the point of encryption or encrypted data in the first place, and Apple, among other companies, have mostly refused to cooperate. According to
assuming that it exists. The backdoor isn't there. They want them to build it. I just wanted to say that.
You're not wrong. That's not saying Apple hasn't built a backdoor, but if you assume they've done the encryption correctly, which admittedly is kind of a big assumption, but if you're assuming they've done the encryption correctly, then a backdoor doesn't really exist. So you'd have to have the company do something to weaken it to make it work. However, critics argue that the government having... Oh, I already read that. According to new exposés from Vice, though, the government appears to be doing just fine with cracking smartphone encryption with or without help from the smartphone's creators. At least that's the case when it comes to iPhones. When it comes to Android encryption, the job is reportedly getting increasingly more difficult for investigators. Detective Rex Kaiser, who conducts digital forensics examinations for Fort Worth Police Department, as this state of ICE. A year ago, we couldn't get into iPhones, but we could get into all the Androids. Now, we cannot get into a lot of the Androids. Vice's investigation into the matter shows that Cellbrite, one of the most prominent companies that the government agencies hire to crack smartphones, has a cracking tool that can break into any iPhone made up to and including the iPhone X. The tool pulls data such as GPS records, messages, call logs, contacts, and even data from specific apps such as Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn, etc., all of which could be incredibly helpful for prosecuting criminals, assuming that this is only used in the, you know, best possible light. However, that same Cellbrite cracking tool is much less successful with Android encryption on prominent handsets. For example, the tool could not extract any social media, internet browsing, or GPS data from devices such as the Google Pixel 2, the Galaxy S9, or in the case of the Huawei P20 Pro, the cracking software literally got nothing. I haven't looked at the Huawei phone. I mean, it's Huawei, so I'm not sure that's a great idea, but... Yeah, pictures, it looks like a decent enough phone. I still don't know that I would recommend buying anything labeled Huawei. Some of the newer operating systems are harder to get data from than others, Kaiser told Vice. I think a lot of these phone companies are just trying to make it harder for law enforcement to get data from these phones under the guise of consumer privacy. That is not... They're not trying to make it harder for law enforcement. It's because that's how encryption works. It's math. That's how it works. Oh, well. You're never going to convince these people of that because their job is based on them not understanding that concept. So
depends on who it is. The media is not going to do it because gear sells.
That's true.
And cops want to get into your phone. Now, I'll concede, I believe most cops want to get into your phone for legitimate reasons, so they're going to leave me alone and they're going to go after the criminals. But I don't want encryption to be broken because I have a checking account, and I stopped using cash for the most part. On occasion, I have cash. Usually, I'm using a debit card. And if encryption is easy to break, it's easy to get to my money.
I do a lot of banking.
I don't want it easy to get to my money.
Shopping and taxes online. So, yeah. Let's see. If you own one of the Android phones just mentioned or even newer phones from those same companies, don't think your phone is uncrackable. Just because Cellbrite's tools don't work doesn't mean investigators can't extract the data they need. The process just becomes more labor-intensive and takes in even more time and resources. Even a brand new phone, such as the iPhone 11 Pro Max, can be cracked, according to Vice's sources. It just isn't as easy as hooking up to a cracking tool and watching the data flow. Either way, Vice's article heavily suggests that Android phones are the safer alternative as compared to iPhones if your main concern is security and privacy. Well, if your main concern is security and privacy, you shouldn't put anything on your phone at all. Seriously. Like, keep it on a hard drive at home. Offline. Like, go buy a Western Digital 8-terabyte hard drive. Only hook it up when you need to back up something to it or access the data on it. And when you don't, unplug it and put it in the shelf. And if you have evidence of a crime on there, Well, I was going to say lock it in a lockbox, but if you have evidence of crime on there, you should, you know, probably go talk to your lawyer and the police and get that shit straightened out rather than, you know, hiding it away forever.
Or nuke the hard drive.
Again, that's like giving good advice to the bad guys. So is that really something I want? Pull a Sarah Connor and
keep
the chips
bag. Incriminating evidence. That's how they caught Capone.
No, no. If you're going to pull a Sarah Connor, you need to go to a metal foundry and just chuck anything incriminating into the molten steel.
Yes! Yes, and a bottle of water. Any bottle of water.
Okay, you can chuck the bottle of water. I'll be back over here out of the building. Wonder what happens if you chuck ice in there.
Dead. A lot of people are going to die. Can you videotape it?
Either way, for now the article makes it seem Android encryption is the way to go. Okay, so of course, you know, it's from Android Authority, so they're very much on the side of Android is better. But you know, again, just for the reasons we talked about it before, just all the differences, you know, in Android phones out there versus iPhones being fairly, you know, standardized. I could see that.
Well, then, in this case, it wouldn't be that Android is better. It's that certain Androids are better.
Yes. Yeah, if you're using the 10-year-old Android 2.0 smartphone, probably not so much. So... And again, if you're really concerned about data security, don't put anything sensitive on your phone. Or, if you must have something sensitive on your phone, maybe don't carry it with you when you're going to encounter people who are going to search your phone. You know, just tell them you don't have a phone, and then they'll nightstick you. I mean, RU claims he doesn't have a phone all the time. How often have you been accosted by law enforcement for that?
Once.
Okay, how about non-law enforcement?
Yesterday. Well, I made a doctor's appointment.
Can I get your cell phone number, please?
Yeah. We see your information isn't completed here. You're going to have to need to complete the information before we can book you in. Well, I have been here for the last five years. You know, I haven't changed. Nothing's changed. She goes, no, you need your mobile phone. Don't have one. Come on now. Everybody's got a mobile phone. Just... We won't sell the information or anything. That's what you're worried about. No, I don't have one. I'm sick of the conversation.
This is where you just get a burner phone that you know, set to silent and never answer just to make them stop.
I bought a burner phone, right? I carried it home in the bag, left it in the box. Battery's gone flat, and I've never opened the box. So I'm like, all right, fuck it. 2019, I'm going to drag myself into the future. Got myself a shitty little phone. And just went, you know what? No, I'm not doing this. This is not happening. I just don't see the need, man.
Yeah, if you don't have a need for it, I mean, why would you pay for something you're not going to use?
That's pretty much it. Like... if I'm not out with you, then I'm out doing something else and I don't need to talk to you. I'm not a doctor. I can't deliver your baby, but I will take the home movie and upload it to the internet for people to watch.
So,
are you another story there?
Yeah. Yep. Next one up is from The Verge. Antivirus company shuts down its data harvesting arm after getting caught red-handed.
Boopsie.
Whoops. Just days after Avast's popular antivirus software was revealed to be harvesting browsing data and selling it to advertisers, the company has said it's shutting down the subsidiary that made it possible. Writing in a blog post, the company CEO, oh God, that's a name, Andrei Vajcik, said Avast is terminating its jump shot subsidiary data collection and operations with immediate effect, and doesn't mention any plans to transfer the company's hundreds, quote unquote, of affected employees, meaning they're likely out of a job. Protecting people is Avast's top priority and must be embedded in everything we do in our business and our products. Anything to the contrary is unacceptable, Vilcek wrote. For these reasons, I, together with the board of directors, have decided to terminate the JumpShot data collection and wind down JumpShot's operations with immediate effects. The reports, which were the result of a joint investigation between Motherboard and PC Mag, detailed how Avast was collecting user browsing data via its antivirus software. The data included Google searches, location lookups, visited URLs, along with precise timestamps, and even in some cases, specific searches made on porn websites. Uh-oh, you're going to find out that people are, you know, they're going to find out that you're into that My Little Pony stuff, and you're going to start getting some weird advertisements. You got to think what kind of filters they have to have on that to turn it into useful data. You know, things that they can actually use for advertising at the same time without getting, you know, immediately sued.
I don't know, man. I just think they're harvesting everything and they'll sort it out later.
No, it's probably the correct answer right there. Motherboard yep. spoke to, well, I mean, hard drives aren't exactly expensive anymore. Motherboard spoke to experts who said this could be possible in some cases. JumpShot claimed to have data from as many as 100 million devices, and it listed some of the world's largest companies among its clients, including Google, Yelp, Microsoft, and Pepsi. Because Pepsi wants to know your porn habits. Actually, the sick part is they probably do.
Well, they want to know when you need to be rehydrated, see?
JumpShot would package this data into different products, one of which was its all-click feed, which would allow its clients to see all user clicks on individual domains, such as Amazon.com. These clients reportedly paid millions of dollars for JumpShot's products, which often included precise browsing data. Although Avast has announced that it's bringing JumpShot to an end, Vilcek defended the way in which the company collected the data, as well as stressing that JumpShot operated as an independent company, and that he said both Avast and JumpShot acted fully with legal bounds and committed themselves 100% to GDPR compliance. Oh, they don't have the money quote in here. There was another quote in here by this guy who was like, well, you know, we're really sorry if our data collection hurt your feelings. And it's not in there. I thought I saw that in one of the other articles, so maybe it was a headline or something, but it was like, Psychro says, hey, now some videos feature people doing very creative things with Pepsi bottles. Two girls, what? Oh, no, that was a cup, not a Pepsi bottle. That's not the kind of advertising you want for your company.
Wow, that's a fucking Super Bowl ad right there for Pepsi, isn't it?
reshoot that, but with a Pepsi bottle instead of a glass. See how long they can get it aired before it just gets yanked. And let's talk about them FTC. Actually, I could see a company paying the FTC fines to air shit like that if they honestly thought it would work. You know?
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, we'll just pay the fine. It's fine. Anyways. Okay. Anything on this before we move on?
Good.
All right. Next one up is from Ars Technica. Plague Ink Maker. Don't use our game for modeling coronavirus.
Aw.
Endemic warns the title is not a scientific model after the spike in
lies.
Interest in the continued spread of the coronavirus has an unintended side effect for UK-based Endemic Creations, makers of Plague Inc., the 8-year-old game which asks players to shepherd a worldwide pandemic so it can destroy all of humanity, has seen a spike in population in recent weeks, becoming the most downloaded iPhone app in China on January 21st and in the United States on January 23rd, according to tracking from App Annie. The surge in interest has led Endemic to issue a statement urging players not to rely on the app for information on staying safe from the coronavirus's current spread. Please remember that Plague Inc. is a game, not a scientific model, and that the current coronavirus outbreak is a very real situation which is impacting a huge number of people, the statement reads in part. We would always recommend that players get their information directly from local and global health authorities. At the same time, Endemic notes that Plague Inc. was specifically designed to be realistic and informative, while not sensationalizing serious real-world issues. The company points to a 2013 CDC interview, which highlights the online research that went into the game, as well as its use as an educational tool. Teachers and professors often get in touch to let me know how they've used Plague Inc. to illustrate biological and economical concepts to their students. I don't remember economies being
God,
in that
no
game.
Wonder kids are coming out of school retarded.
This is not the first time Plague Inc. has benefited from a real-world epidemic news. Endemic also issued a statement during the 2014 Ebola outbreak, noting the game's contribution to global health charities. For example, Endemic notes that whenever there's an outbreak of disease, we see an increase in players as people seek to find out more about how diseases spread and how to understand the concepts of a viral outbreak.
It's a fucking game. Yeah, I use Grand Theft Auto to simulate what would happen if I decided to go and give a fuck one day. You know, like, fuck off.
No. We use Grand Theft Auto to plan our next crime spree, obviously. I mean, well, why not? The military was using Doom to plan operations for a while. Admittedly, they made custom maps that actually, you know, made sense, but... this time around, the added interest in the game has been large enough to take the Endemic website offline temporarily due to very high player numbers. Endemic also tweeted that its servers for multiplayer and custom scenarios are struggling to cope with the very high player numbers. Endemic points players to the WHO for up-to-date information on the coronavirus. The disease has now spread to more than 2,800 reported cases worldwide and has led to at least 80 deaths. And this is from the 27th, so those numbers are not up to date.
It's 200 and something now.
Well, didn't China get caught, like, sending bodies off to cremation without, like, identifying what they were?
I don't know, man. None of those stories can be verified. They could be real. They could be fake. But there's videos going around of them welding doors shut on homes. I don't think they're real either. But you never know, man. It is fucking China.
I need to get one of those plague doctor masks for next week. So if anybody's wondering, I think we mentioned at the beginning of the show that when there might not be a show Thursday, I have to get on an airplane. So
you need to do is when you get on, is motorboat the seat, breathe really fucking deep. Just get your face right in there.
I want to get one of those old-timey plague doctor outfits. Just walk on the plane wearing that.
You'd probably get charged with terroristic offenses.
Beak thing?
Yes!
I remember to stuff it with rose petals.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, what are you doing? I'm making sure I don't get coronavirus, obviously. Well, sir, nobody is sitting within a 20-meter radius of you on the plane, and it's causing problems. Because
you again are freak out the 300-pound sassy black lady at the TSA, man. She ain't going to know what your white shit is up to.
Haven't you seen a medieval plague doctor's outfit before? This beak is stuffed with posies and rose petals. I'll be fine.
Now, walking into the meeting at work like that the next day.
Just switch out the potpourri.
Anyways. Next article. All right. This one is from Game of Sutra. And it says, Blizzard automatically owns any and all Warcraft 3 Reforged custom games. This is them, you know, really being butthurt over Defense of the Ancients. Let's see. A freshly released remaster of Warcraft 3, dubbed Warcraft 3 Reforged, gives its players the tools they need to create custom game modes and maps. But this time around, Blizzard's end-user license agreement gives the studio ownership of any community-made custom content. New rules surrounding custom games are spotted by users on the Blizzard forums and come partnered with other restrictions that forbid creations made using copyrighted material or content deemed inappropriate. Blizzard's automatic ownership of custom games is especially interesting, a new rule that hit the Warcraft 3 remaster, one no doubt tied to the fact that some custom game modes for the original Warcraft 3 went on to become massively successful standalone game franchises like Dota. So yeah, same thing. Or I read the article earlier and just remembered it. Anyways, under the updated EULA, Blizzard gets immediate ownership of any custom games made for Warcraft 3 Reforged, and if the creator isn't able to give those rights away, Blizzard is instead granted an exclusive, perpetual, worldwide, unconditional, royalty-free, irrevocable license, enabling Blizzard to fully exploit the custom games or any content thereof for any purpose and in any manner whatsoever.
They also get your firstborn, well, and get the right to sleep with your wife on your wedding night.
And not just custom games, but like any content related to those custom games. Like if you create characters or story arcs for like custom maps, they own it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I read it all yesterday.
Apparently, they updated the World of Warcraft terms of service to basically claim that they own all the player characters. So, basically Blizzard is claiming ownership of anything regarding their games. Like, you make something in their games, too bad, they own it. They're just nice in letting you use it.
Yeah, it's a big fuck-off for me with Blizzard.
Oh, that mask isn't all that expensive, although the air holes are kind of you kind of defeat the point.
Yeah. Yeah, moving along. Blizzard being Blizzard again.
Depending on the game, can you really use it outside of the game? Like the Warcraft, the World of Warcraft model. So I'm rolling up an orc, and then I have their tree to go down, or one of their other trees to go down, depending on whatever class I'm going. Not really useful outside of World of Warcraft.
Well, I mean, people made webcomics and shit back in the day about their World of Warcraft characters, so there's all kinds of art and shit out there.
On that one, I didn't create it in World of Warcraft. I created it in Adobe.
Apparently, several book series started out as bad fan fiction of other books, so, I mean, you know, I could see that. But
on that one, Warcraft wouldn't be able to enforce anything. All their shit's from Dungeons and Dragons, Warhammer, and Norse mythology.
Wouldn't stop them.
They'd try.
Yep. Dude, they're as arrogant as the mouse.
So, I just, you know... That's just real interesting that they're claiming ownership of any custom game modes made in the custom map editor. So, but yeah, that's exactly what it is. They put that in there because of Defense of the Ancients. I think they even tried to claim ownership of that back in the day and then got told, you know, nope. So, because the guys who made the mod ended up selling it to Valve. And, no, they didn't sell it to Valve. They sold it to somebody else and then they sold it to, and I don't remember. Been too long. Also, doesn't really matter. Anyways, last article I have for tonight, this one was sent to me by RU. So, and it's actually a follow-up from an article we talked about last week. This is from NASASpaceFlight.com. I'm sorry, NASA Space Flight. NASA Space Fight is a completely different website. Two satellites came close to colliding in orbit Wednesday, highlighting the potential hazards posed by debris in space. The derelict Poppy 7B and the IRAS spacecraft made their closest approach, predicted to have been within 47 meters at 2339 UTC, high above the U.S. state of Pennsylvania. Had a collision occurred, it would have left a field of debris in low Earth orbit. There has only been one accidental collision between two intact satellites in different orbits. This occurred 11 years ago, involving a then-operational satellite in the Iridium communications network and a defunct Russian communications satellite. In contrast, both the satellites involved in Wednesday's near-miss had been inactive for at least 36 years. Yeah, I guess I didn't. You don't really think about the fact that we've had satellites up there that long, that both of these things have been inactive that long. Poppy 7B is a military satellite that was launched by the United States in the 1960s, weighing about 83 kilograms. The Infrared Astronomical Satellite, IRAS, is a retired scientific satellite, which conducted the first infrared all-sky astronomical survey in 1983. It had a mass at launch of 1,073 kilograms. The close approach between the
over a ton.
Yep. A close approach between the two satellites occurred at about 900 kilometers above the United States near the city of Pittsburgh. Had a collision occurred, it would have posed no danger to anyone on the ground. Conservation of momentum means that any debris would have fanned out in orbit, and even if or when fragments began to re-enter the atmosphere, they would have burned up before getting over near the ground. Had the satellites collided, the biggest effect would have been an increase in the amount of small debris in orbit, slightly increasing the risk of damage to other satellites from subsequent collisions. Oh, I misread this. I thought we were talking about the same one from last week.
I did too, man, and I misread it last night when I was going through it.
Scrolling further down the story, they mention that the other satellite.
It's my bad. I got the story wrong.
But it's still amazing that we have satellites up there that old that are just, you know, coming close to ramming into each other. Because I'm thinking that eventually you're going to get this kind of chain effect where one hits and that creates a field of debris that starts damaging other satellites. And
I would think, or I'd hope that there is a team of people out there working on a way to recover some of this shit in the next couple of years, you know?
Well, Cycros had a plan in the IRC of just launching a giant, you know, Wile E. Coyote magnet as a satellite.
There you go. The only problem is most of those alloys up there aren't magnet, not being able to be attracted by a magnet.
They're not ferrous?
Yeah. Thank you, man. I forgot the word for a minute. Fucking Friday, I'm allowed to.
So, I think that they are going to have to come up with some means of capturing these defunct satellites and doing something with them. The problem is that a lot of them are shut down, and they're so shut down there's no way to send commands to them to, like, you know, crash yourself into the ocean or something like that. That would make sense for getting them out of there. Or, you know, shoot them. I guess you could shoot them off into deep space and let them transmit for as long as they can, see what kind of data you get off of them.
Oh, yeah, so we're just going to fling our shit from our planet off to somebody else's poor motherfucker's planet.
It's a good practice. Humans have been doing it for how long now?
I know, but fuck.
And if it makes it there, you never know. We could inspire a really cool religion, like the aircraft cults in the Pacific. Yeah. Ancient tribe picks up a tape recorder?
Anything like the Skylab incident, you're going to think water is Australia.
you know?
Or then we could also do the whole V'ger thing. It'll come back and try to kill us.
I use cargo cults as an example way too often at work, now that I think about it. Well, it's a good analogy for people doing things without understanding why they're doing them. So, anyways.
Yeah, all right. Dojo.
Dojo. Chariots of Fire with the Coke bottle. Oh. Anyways, yeah, Psychro's getting just all kinds of nasty there in the chat room. First thing I have for you tonight, even from Dojo, is an interesting GitHub link from the Hacker's Choice. This is a collection of interesting tricks for the Linux command line, especially for Linux command lines that maybe you've gotten access to that you shouldn't have. And it's just a whole bunch of different gists and tricks with Linux. You've got all kinds of stuff here from, you know, turning off the history file in Bash so they can't see what commands you were typing. You know, how to set up an SSH connection that looks invisible. SSH tunneling. ARP discovery of computers on the local network. Of course, that's just an nmap command, but, you know, still, it's good reference. Some different encoding techniques. There was something else in here when I was scrolling through it earlier. Oh, yeah, the reverse shell stuff. So they had all kinds of stuff in here for doing reverse shells and setting up backdoors and even monitoring, like, other local users. So, you know, just a fun set of tricks if you're messing around with Linux or you're, you know, even find yourself on a Linux box and wanting to play around and see what you can do with it. Interesting reading, if nothing else. And then the final thing I have for you tonight in Dojo is Kali Linux has released version 2020.1, and it's the end of an era. They have changed the default login. Ever since it was called Backtrack, they used root and then a password of, you know, root spelled backwards or Tor. So whenever you saw a Kali box, you could almost, unless they changed the password, which actually was kind of rare, you know, whenever you found one, you could almost guess that you could get into it using the root Tor combination. Well, they have gotten rid of that. They're going with the Ubuntu model of not having a password on root. And instead, they have the default user of Kali with a password of Kali, and you can just sudo right up. So, it's the end of an era, man. They've actually gotten rid of root Tor, which that's been years, right?
We are getting old, my friend.
Yeah. Yeah. They've also split it up, and then they made kind of a unified installer instead of a whole bunch of different images. So, that's kind of interesting, but yeah, so, you know, that's a big change, actually, getting rid of just default running as root for Kali. And, of course, they were doing that because most of the tools needed that. But it's gotten to the point now where they're saying, you know, if you want to run it as a desktop, you can. They used to say not to do it. They used to say it is not a general purpose OS. Do not run this as your day-to-day. Now they're saying, well, you can if you want to. We just don't support it. So, you know, that's just, I don't know. Half the time I don't even bother with Kali anymore. I just go grab whatever tool I need and move on with life. But it's still a quick way to get something up and running, especially for Wi-Fi stuff, because with Wi-Fi stuff, you still usually need to muck around with drivers and kernel modules. So it's just a quick way to get up and running. But anyways. So that's all I've got for tonight. Of course, listen to the stream. We're always working on it. Pure Decking every Thursday. Galaxy15 radio site. The subreddit and in the IRC tonight. Myself, Sardonyx, Psychros, Haratz, and Medman. Medman, closing thoughts.
I don't know. I kind of voiced him at the beginning. I'm kind of annoyed that PETA wants to take away Phil's job and replace him with a robot. Although it did look like a really cool animatronic gopher.
Is it like the old Chuck E. Cheese robots, you know, all pneumatics and, you know, working in time to an audio tape that slowly degrades?
Now, I think more Disney Imagineer got a hold of it. Although that got me thinking of all of the robotic gophers on Groundhog's Day eventually going insane and attempting to overthrow humanity. They'll make us think that it's continuous winter. They'll never see their shadow.
And then, in the dark
of night, kill us in our sleep.
I'm now imagining the groundhog from Groundhog's Day with a leather jacket and sunglasses on and the Terminator theme playing in the background. Don't worry.
Bill Murray will be able to take it out. I mean, he's got eternity to figure this.
All right. Are you closing thoughts?
Looking forward to dying from the woohoo flu. That's about it. So I'm loving this. I'm going to find an Asian person to go spit in my mouth so I can prove how woke I am. I'm not afraid of the woohoo flu. Are you? Anyway.
I'm going to be wearing a Plague Doctor's outfit on the plane. What are you talking about?
Dude, if you do, man, get a selfie. Only selfie with the TSA lady just looking at you like fucking white people. You know what I mean?
Yeah, because that's what it would be.
That's what's going to happen. But
you just show up to the plane with the Plague Doctor. They're like, oh, hell no.
And get on board the hashtags Hot Girls for Bernie. Check that one out if you're interested today, boys.
Hot Girls for Bernie, huh?
Yeah, I'll explain when off the show. That way, whoever's interested now, right now, can run out and look at it.
Well, I mean, I
you
guess
kids that's, and your Twitters.
I guess that's one way to get a date. I mean,
oh yes,
yeah, sure. I'll vote for Bernie. Why not? Of course, I imagine that would be a very effective campaign. You vote for this person, get laid.
That's what Andrew Yang's working for. Yang gang.
No, he's going the old-fashioned way of paying for votes.
Exactly.
Everyone in America will get a $2,000 dividend.
Oh, I thought it was 2,000. I thought it was 1,000.
A grand a month, isn't it?
It's freedom payment or whatever he was talking about, yeah.
Yeah. Which will be taxed.
At $1,000 a month?
Just watch inflation go through the roof. That's all it'll be.
That's exactly what it'll be. Everybody will increase their prices.
It'll just go up.
In fact, exactly. it'll be more expensive. It's like raising the minimum wage, right? Yeah, sure, you make an extra buck an hour, but the cost of everything goes up whatever percentage it is, and it ends up being way more expensive to live than it was before.
Yeah.
So.
Good luck.
Anyways, that's all I got. I'm gonna hit the sounds on the soundboard now.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.
Sounds good, no doubt, and call it a night.
Shut up, Wesley.